to bring an end to Colombia, and we need to have a new role, production based on knowledge, production without carbon, a decarbonized production, and therefore a new democracy. This is what we propose to the world, and this new progressive axis would have very powerful allies, humankind itself, and would display its moral and political superiority. It's a superiority of arguments based on science. That, I believe, is what we are now building in Colombia and in Latin America. That is the way forward that we are going to be trying to insist on in coming months and coming years.
That's Gustavo Petro speaking on Democracy Now! In 2018, after losing to the right-wing presidential candidate Iván Duque. Gustavo Petro is now set to become Colombia's first leftist president, former M19 guerrilla, former mayor of Bogota. To see the full interview with him, as well as with the vice president-elect, Francia Márquez Mina, the first Afro-Colombian environmentalist vice president, the first black vice president of Colombia, you can go to democracynow.org. And finally, today, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection is holding its fourth public hearing today with a focus on Donald Trump's efforts to pressure state officials to overturn the 2020 election. Democracy Now! Will stream the hearing live at democracynow.org beginning at 1 p.m. Eastern. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berk, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tommy Warnoff, Cam Baker, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Mary Conlin, Juan Carlos Davila. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Listener-supported community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Good in the Hood from Friday, June 24th through Sunday, June 26th at King School Park in Portland. Good in the Hood is an annual three-day benefit festival celebrating unity in the community. Festivities include live music, food, and a parade. Again, that's Good in the Hood from Friday, June 24th through Sunday, June 26th at King School Park, 4815 Northeast 7th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon ranks fifth in the nation for its COVID response. The House Committee on January 6th holds its fourth public hearing, and Biden appoints the first Native American treasurer in U.S. history. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 21st, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon ranks fifth in the nation for its coronavirus response, according to a report from the Commonwealth Fund that looked at healthcare across the 50 states. Oregon trails Hawaii, Maine, Washington, and Vermont in the rankings. These were determined by factors like vaccination rates, hospitalization rates, and death rates. The study also looked at other aspects of healthcare, and Oregon doesn't place as highly by those metrics. Overall, Oregon is number 14 across the country when it comes to healthcare. Specifically, though, Oregon has a couple outlier statistics, like being 47th in the country for adults who have lost six or more teeth. Additionally, Oregon health officials estimate that COVID cases in the state could be 20 to 30 times higher than what is currently being reported. Many people are testing at home and not reporting their results, and others may get mild enough symptoms that they don't end up testing at all. A week ago, three Oregon counties reached the federal high-risk level for coronavirus, meaning universal masking is recommended but not required. Residents in Lane, Douglas, and Jackson counties are recommended to mask up to prevent the spread of COVID, especially indoors. Oregon officials approved vaccine doses for children as young as 6 months old this weekend after the FDA gave the go-ahead for low doses for young children. Both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines have received emergency authorization from the FDA for use in children as young as 6 months old. Today was the fourth public hearing by the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. Lawmakers revealed evidence that former President Trump was directly involved with the scheme to produce false electors in states where Biden had won. Republican National Convention Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel testified that Trump called her personally to try to enlist her help in the scheme. Also implicated were two Congress members who were involved with securing false electors. Representative Andy Biggs of Arizona called his state's House Speaker on January 6th and asked him to overturn the vote. Later that day, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin texted an aide of then-Vice President Mike Pence saying he had false electors from Michigan and from Wisconsin. The aide to Pence turned down the offer. Even top Trump campaign lawyers knew they didn't have evidence of election fraud. One witness testified that presidential lawyer Rudy Giuliani said, quote, "We've got lots of theories, we just don't have the evidence," end quote. The hearing also featured testimony from elections officials and poll workers from states where Trump was attempting to overturn the popular election of Joe Biden. They testified about the threats, epithets, stalking, and home invasions they experienced, among other things. The final public hearing held by the committee will be on Thursday. Once the committee has presented all their evidence, they may recommend charges to the Justice Department related to their findings. Youth crime rates have fallen steadily over the past few decades, but some parts of the media are telling a different story. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Crime rates among young people has dropped dramatically in recent decades, despite media coverage pointing toward a supposed crime wave led by youth. That's the finding in a recent report from the Sentencing Project, which shows the share of overall arrests of people younger than 18 was cut in half between 2000 and 2019. Dina Corso is the Juvenile Services Division Director for Multnomah County.
The trend very much for juvenile crime nationally, and then it's mirrored here locally, has been sharp, sharp decreases in juvenile crime. And any efforts to have the pendulum swing back the other way would be not only detrimental to young people, but also contradictive to public safety.
Corso says in Multnomah County, the number of crime referrals for young people has decreased from about 2,200 in 2011 to 500 in 2021. In 2019, Multnomah County completed the Transforming Juvenile Probation Certificate Program, which emphasizes expanding diversion programs, decreasing probation conditions, and increasing incentives that promote positive behaviors. Richard Mendel authored the Sentencing Project report. He says people should be skeptical of pushes for more punitive measures, especially when the data doesn't back up the need for it. He says locking kids up can have a detrimental effect that lasts long past youth.
You take them away from school, you take them away from activities of rites of passage in adolescence, and you surround them instead with incarceration with other troubled kids, and it's a negative dynamic that halts their natural progression to age out of these behaviors.
In 2019, Oregon lawmakers updated Measure 11, a voter-passed initiative from 1994 that led kids as young as 15 to be charged in adult courts. The updates roll back some of the tough-on-crime positions for young people. Corso says we understand more about young people's brains now than we did when the measure passed.
I am a firm believer in keeping kids in the kid system, meeting youth where they're at developmentally, the incredible capacity that young people have for change and habilitation or rehabilitation.
The Sentencing Project report suggests states follow Oregon and not process youth in adult court. It also urges emphasizing diversion programs and hiring more counselors instead of police officers in schools. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
President Joe Biden will appoint the first Native American to be U.S. Treasurer. Marilyn Malerba is chief of the Mohegan tribe. Current Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said, quote, "For the first time in history, a tribal leader and Native woman's name will be the signature on our currency," end quote. President Joe Biden intends to establish an Office of Tribal and Native Affairs at the Treasury Department. The U.S. Treasurer oversees that office. The Treasurer's duties also include oversight of the U.S. Mint, serving as a liaison with the Federal Reserve, and overseeing the Treasury's Office of Consumer Policy. President Biden has taken other steps to demonstrate his commitment to tribal nations. He named Deb Haaland as the first Native American to lead the Interior Department. Haaland is leading a reckoning with the U.S. government's role in Native American boarding schools, which strip Native children of their cultures and identities. Biden also issued the first presidential proclamation of Indigenous Peoples Day, intending on refocusing the federal holiday previously dedicated to Christopher Columbus towards an appreciation of Native people. Malerba said, quote, "It's especially important that our Native voices are respected. This appointment underscores this administration's commitment to doing just that. I'm excited to serve our communities as treasurer for the work ahead," end quote. Secretary Yellen also said, quote, "Chief Malerba will expand our unique relationship with tribal nations, continuing our joint efforts to support the development of tribal economies and economic opportunities for tribal citizens," end quote. With more on the historic appointment of Chief Lynn Malerba to United States Treasurer, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The chief of the Mohegan tribe, Lynn Malerba, has been tapped as treasurer of the United States. The announcement of President Biden's intent to appoint Malerba was made Tuesday ahead of a visit by the Treasury Department to the Rosebud Sioux tribe in South Dakota. Malerba became chief of the Mohegan tribe in Connecticut in 2010. She's the first woman to serve as top leader in the tribe's modern history. Malerba will also make history at the Department of Treasury as a tribal leader and a Native woman to sign currency. In a statement, Malerba said she's honored and that it's important to have Native voices respected, adding her appointment to the administration underscores just that. She will oversee a newly established Office on Tribal and Native Affairs to communicate with tribes and be a hub for tribal policy. The Treasurer of the U.S. directly oversees the U.S. Mint, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, and is a key liaison with the Federal Reserve. Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen will announce her appointment and the new tribal office during the visit Tuesday to the Rosebud Reservation. Canada's Assembly of First Nations has suspended its national chief. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, it comes a day after she criticized the organization and also faces an investigation over complaints against her.
Roseanne Archibald, the country's first woman to lead the most powerful Native organization in Canada, is calling the suspension a coup. Now she has become the first AFN chief to be locked out, even from her own emails, and it all comes less than a year after her historic election. The AFN says the decision is regrettable, but the national chief has committed serious breaches of her obligations to the organization through her unfounded public attacks against the AFN. Paul Prosper is an AFN regional chief from the East Coast.
She breached her obligations to the company, contrary to her oath of office, to our code of conduct, and the whistleblower policy.
Archibald has faced allegations of bullying and harassment from four of her staff members. After that, the AFN brought in an outside investigator. Archibald is calling it a smear campaign and says she has been trying to clean up the corruption within the organization. And because of that, she says she's been undermined, discredited, and attacked. The AFN would not disclose exactly what the complaints against her are. Archibald has been suspended with pay pending the outcome of an investigation. She will not be able to attend the annual General Assembly or the Chief's Assembly and is prohibited from discussing the investigation publicly. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs will hold a hearing Wednesday on Indian boarding schools. The hearing will examine the Interior Department's investigative report on boarding schools and on legislation titled the Truth and Healing Commission on Indian Boarding School Policies Act. Native leaders are scheduled to testify about the report, legislation, and what action is needed next. Federal officials from the Interior Department are also expected to appear before the committee. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland has been instrumental in leading efforts to investigate U.S. Indian boarding schools. Advocates have been calling for the Senate committee to hold a hearing on the boarding school legislation and for the House version to be passed. The hearing will be streamed online. A week-long dugout canoe journey hosted by the Ho-Chunk Nation kicked off Monday. Tribal officials and Native youth are making their journey along lakes and rivers in Wisconsin. Tribal leaders say it's an opportunity for young people to take part in the tribe's culture and also provides an educational opportunity for the tribe to share history and culture with the public at stops along the way. Updates of the journey will be posted on the Ho-Chunk Nation Facebook page. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for It Did Happen Here. At 6, we'll hear Transpositive PDX, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 52. Tomorrow we'll see some clouds, but a high of 75. Today in history, in 1989, the Supreme Court ruled in Texas versus Johnson that American flag burning is a form of political protest protected by the First Amendment. The quote of the day is from French philosopher Albert Camus, who said, quote, "Against eternal injustice, man must assert justice, and to protest the universe of grief, he must create happiness." President Biden is asking oil and gas companies to consider putting aside record profits to work on lowering gas prices. But a new analysis shows that creating an excess profits tax could help lower prices for food, gas, healthcare, and housing. Eric Gladys speaks with one of the authors of this report.
President Joe Biden is calling on oil and gas companies to start steering record profits away from shareholder pockets to give Americans some relief at the pump. And new economic analysis suggests that approach could be key to lowering prices across the board. Josh Bivens with the Economic Policy Institute recently deconstructed each major component impacting prices over the past year, including wages, corporate profits, and supply chain issues.
It's overwhelmingly profits. It's not wages. And so normally profits are about 11 to 12%. Of the final price of any good, but they contributed more than 50% to price growth over the 2021 period.
Normally, wages contribute about 60% to the price of goods, but last year, labor came in at just under 8%. Supply chain disruptions accounted for 38% of rising costs. Calls for a windfall profits tax have been largely absent in debates on how to tackle inflation, with some economists noting that the drive to increase corporate profits is just business as usual. Analysis by the group Accountable.us found that top corporations producing food, energy, commodities, healthcare, and housing delivered more than $140 billion to shareholders after raising prices. Bivens says a temporary tax on profits could help counterbalance the pricing power companies currently have over consumers.
You know, if the policy recommendation is to just ask them politely not to raise prices, that would be silly, but it really does put some policy options on the table, like an excess profits tax. You reduce the incentive to raise prices, you're not harming the economy's ability to move resources around in the long run.
Recent polling by Global Strategy Group suggests that Americans are not buying the argument that inflation is being driven by aggregate demand racing ahead of supply. 7 in 10 Republicans, 8 in 10 Independents, and 9 in 10 Democrats blame corporate greed for rapidly rising prices. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
Primary elections featuring Trump-backed candidates are in focus, and President Biden mulls his options for addressing high gas prices. With more on these stories, we go to Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Trump is a career criminal, and most Republicans want him protected. And if you don't, your chances of losing a primary are really, really high.
Democratic strategist James Carville noted former President Donald Trump's support carries a lot of weight as today's elections focus heavily on the Republican side of the aisle. Trump backs Katie Britt, a former Senate aide in Alabama's Senate seat runoff after reversing his initial endorsement of Representative Mo Brooks. The state is also holding primary runoffs for Secretary of State and the 5th Congressional District. Democratic voters in Georgia will decide their candidates for U.S. House seats, Lieutenant Governor, Secretary of State, and Insurance and Labor Commissioners. Republicans in Virginia hope to build on momentum from Governor Glenn Youngkin's upset victory by flipping Democratic-controlled congressional districts. Republican strategist Leslie Sanchez explains voters feel establishment candidates are out of touch.
It is looking increasingly more like a working class, higher income to some extent, but very critical of the government type of voter that is now more aligned with Republicans than Democrats.
In Washington, D.C., voters are deciding among several mayoral candidates, including two-term incumbent mayor Muriel Bowser. President Joe Biden is considering sending Americans gas rebate cards to help ease the burden of high prices. He said he could decide by week's end whether to temporarily pause the 18.3-cent federal gasoline tax. Monday's nationwide average for gas was just under $5 a gallon. Vice President Kamala Harris marked Juneteenth Monday with a surprise visit to school children at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Harris said the nation defined freedom in its opposition to slavery.
It was a step toward making real the ideals set forth at the founding of our nation, that we are all entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Oregon Congressman Jeff Merkley and other members of Congress used Juneteenth to point out the need for worker protections for people who are incarcerated and often forced to work for very little pay.
We still have slavery in our 13th Amendment, a loophole that allows slavery to continue as a punishment for a crime and launch not just re-enslavement for hundreds of thousands of individuals, but also mass incarceration that continues to this day.
The average minimum wage for people in prison is 52 cents an hour. Monday also marked World Refugee Day. As a goodwill ambassador for the UN, comedian Ben Stiller visited Ukraine, touring occupied settlements in the war-torn country.
War and violence are devastating people all over the world. Nobody chooses to flee their home. Seeking safety is a right, and it needs to be upheld for every person.
Last week, President Joe Biden announced more than $1 billion in security and humanitarian assistance will be granted to Ukraine as the war with Russia continues. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eTrust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Pandemic deaths are at lower rates now, but many families around the country are still grieving the loss of loved ones to COVID. That includes children. Mike Moen speaks with experts in South Dakota about helping kids overcome this trauma.
Roughly 200,000 children in the U.S. have lost a caregiver to COVID-19. In South Dakota, mental health experts say these cases can have added complications as kids grieve, and a range of support is needed for a strong emotional recovery. Nikki Eining is a therapist with Avera Behavioral Health and board member for the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment. She says loss of a biological parent falls under the scope of adverse childhood experiences. Eining explains it can affect the child's development because they lost a relationship that's difficult to replace.
I might not be receiving that nurturing piece from that caregiver anymore when I've developed that bond to that caregiver as an infant or a toddler or even an early elementary-aged youth.
And with social distancing requirements, the child may not have had a chance to say goodbye, and those rules may have kept their support system at bay during the mourning phase. Eining says that's why it's important for adults in their lives to help build new trusted relationships that offer a sense of bonding. That involvement can come from outside the home, including neighbors, teachers, and coaches. Maureen Murray with Youth and Family Services in Rapid City says her office has responded to a handful of these cases. She says in situations where a child has to suddenly adapt to a new environment, that can extend the grieving even longer.
A move, a different school system, loss of friends, even if the surviving parent is struggling with their own grief and is not there emotionally for the child.
She says it's dangerous to assume all kids are resilient, noting some will not show how much they're struggling emotionally. Murray says providing safe spaces for them to talk when they're ready is important, while adding therapy such as individual sessions or grief camps can help. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
The Trump presidency eroded diplomacy and cooperation with other countries, but what has President Biden done to reject and reform that past? Now we go to a Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. I'm among those analysts who expected important foreign policy moves by the Biden administration that would separate it from the transactional, uninformed, and dysfunctional policies of the Trump years. Instead, we've gotten a foreign policy that is different in style, but not so much in substance, the most significant departure from Trump being the rebuilding of coalitions and alliances in Europe and Asia, not all of which are really meaningful. Otherwise, what we see are deepening confrontations with Russia and China, no reversal of the trade war with China, new missile tests in North Korea, no resumption of the nuclear deal with Iran, an energy crisis leading to a reported reset of relations with the murderous Saudi Arabia regime, a pass for authoritarian regimes that abuse human rights but are so-called strategic partners, a military budget closing in on $1 trillion, the highest level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in human history, and of course, an incredibly destructive war in Ukraine that looks nowhere near ending. Joe Biden's team has shown no ability to craft diplomatic breakthroughs, lead on urgent global issues, or, as was once promised, bring foreign policy into line with domestic priorities. And with Democrats facing loss of control of both houses of Congress in this year's legislative elections, Biden's ability to move initiatives forward on either the domestic or international front will be largely eviscerated. Credit the Biden administration with making modest headway on domestic matters, such as reversing Trump-era environmental deregulation, ramping up COVID vaccinations, pushing through a large infrastructure bill, and appointing the first black woman to the Supreme Court. But abroad, the president has let slide several opportunities to defy political opponents and show initiative. He could reverse the Cold War orientation of U.S. policy on China, which has convinced Beijing that the U.S. again seeks to contain it. Specifically, he could propose initiatives to China that might weaken its support of Putin's war on Ukraine. He could reach agreement with Iran that would reinstate the nuclear deal and immediately free up Iran's oil exports, bringing down U.S. prices at the pump. He could press North Korea to accept vaccine help and thus restart direct diplomacy at a time when the North is again engaging in missile tests and possibly preparing for a nuclear weapon test. He could fulfill his campaign promises on Saudi Arabia by rejecting a strategic partnership until the kingdom stops bombing in Yemen. Never mind the fantasy that the Saudis will save us with increased oil production. He could get tough with the Saudis, the Indians, the Israelis, and other U.S. friends that systematically repress human rights, but continue receiving substantial U.S. military and other assistance. And he could come down hard on the fossil fuel industry's profiteering and plans to expand production at the expense of the environment. The absence of real leadership and creativity in foreign policy deepens a hole Biden dug by withdrawing so sloppily from Afghanistan and, so far as the Afghans left behind are concerned, so irresponsibly. His administration looks like it lacks a clear global strategy beyond democracy versus autocracy, a slogan without substance or serious definition. As in past years, governments that pretend to be a friend of the U.S. don't have to answer for being undemocratic. Part of the problem is that Biden chose mainstream liberals for top national security and foreign policy positions, people whose views reflect Cold War thinking on adversaries and security partners, and are beholden to the principles of power politics. So, while they're a world apart from Trump-era diplomacy that saw no value in alliances and cozied up to Russia, these officials have put the U.S. in an equally bad place, a proxy war with Russia, and with no sense of how that war can be ended, short of the total destruction of Ukraine, the permanent isolation of Russia, and a Europe struggling to preserve its unity and its economies. These shortcomings coincide with the greatest threat to national security, far-right terrorism at home. Inflation is nothing compared with the very real chance that the Trumpian far-right will capture control of both houses of Congress, threatening the very foundations of democratic governance, and once again withdrawing the U.S. from influential roles in alliances, coalitions, and international organizations. Biden will only be able to expect support from the Republicans for three wrong-headed policies: confronting China, providing endless military aid to Ukraine, both as part of an outrageously high military budget, and drilling for more oil. Taking decisive action on global warming, immigration, and other so-called intermestic issues will be out the window. The president and the Democrats are running out of time to get their act together and think outside the box when it comes to peace, social justice, and real security at home. I'm Mel Gertov, the Global Citizen. Thank you very much for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 21st, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Eric Pilatus, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for It Did Happen Here.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
He was an Ethiopian immigrant. He'd come here, and I guess he was a college student. You know, I don't know him personally at all, but I mean, that's just an innocent person, you know, who came here for school and a better life, and these guys killed him.
The crime took place here on South